Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 446, titled Funds and Games, being recorded on February 15th of the year 2004. WFMU archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, older programs at a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, Spitfire List is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 446 within a week or so of the airing of this program. Now, FTR 446 is a follow-up to, among other programs, FTRs 426, 427, and 428. We're going to be revisiting a consummately important recent book called Gold Warriors, subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. This was published by Verso Books and co-authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. It was my pleasure to visit with Peggy Seagrave in For the Record program number 428. In program 427 and 428, we took a look at the Japanese looting of Asia in World War II, a subject we also looked at in FTR 290. And we're going to take a look once again at the outgrowths of Operation Golden Lily. That was the Imperial Japanese Royal Family's name, the official title of the program of looting of Asia. We're going to be taking a look at what happened with the monies that were secreted in Japan during World War II. And in particular, we're going to take a look at some of the outgrowths of the gold that was secreted in underground vaults in the Philippines. Over $100 billion, and that's billion dollars in early 1940s dollars, was secreted in the underground vaults in the Philippines alone. This plus the Borman Flight Capital, the capital that was looted by the Germans in World War II, estimated by the British to have exceeded $180 billion by early 1943 alone, minus what they took from the Soviet Union and Greece. And again, that's early 1940s dollars. What we're looking at is one of the most important economic and political factors in the modern world, which is the economic implications that grew out of World War II and the tremendous concentration of capital in Japan and Germany, the reinstitution of Axis elements and their re-anointing by the United States in order to fight the Cold War, something I now believe has come back to haunt the United States because now this great country faces subversion and perhaps destruction at the hands of these very same elements who, for all of the shortcomings of American democracy, and there are no shortage of those, they have always viewed the United States as something to be done away with, an obstacle to world totalitarianism. What we're going to do in this broadcast is to revisit the book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave, again published by Verso Books, and we're going to take a look at a number of different funds. That is the title of the part of the title of the broadcast. We're going to take a look at the Black Eagle Trust. This was a giant slush fund put together to fight communism, used to bribe governments. Eventually, it was used to shore up. It was used as a major asset for major commercial banks around the world, which it still is. It also was used to underwrite the post-World War II Bretton Woods Conference-generated international monetary system, a rationale that the authors of this book feel was probably exaggerated by the formulators of this policy. In addition to the Black Eagle Trust, we're going to take a look at the M Fund, or the Marquardt Fund. That, too, was derived from the loot that was plundered by Japan in World War II. It was named for MacArthur aide General Marquardt, and it was used to basically fix post-war Japanese political life. Eventually, the M Fund was turned over to Japanese politicians associated with the LDP, and it continues to play a profound role in world politics. After looking at the M Fund, we're going to take a look at three funds. We're going to take a look at the Yatsuya Fund. The Yatsuya Fund was basically used, again, to restructure post-war Japan in order to return to power the fascist elements who had launched the Japanese element of World War II. The Yatsuya Fund, administered by MacArthur's intelligence chief, General Charles Willoughby, was basically used to manipulate the Japanese underworld and to control it, and also to fund the operations of the Cannon Agency, which basically was an assassination organization used to eliminate political activists, union leaders, and others deemed to be inimical to the American and reactionary Japanese goals in Japan. After looking at the Yatsuya Fund, we're going to take a look at the Keenan Fund. That was used to bribe witnesses and to finance the destruction of documents in order to rehabilitate Japanese fascist elements. Due to the influence of the Keenan Fund, among others, many of the worst Japanese fascists were returned to power in Japan, and to this day, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, is a residua not only for some of the same individuals, although many obviously have passed away, but for the political ideology and the political philosophy of fascist Japan. Finally, we're going to take a look at the Showa Trust. That was in the Sanwa Bank, a major Japanese commercial bank. It, too, was derived from the plunder, in particular gold, that was looted by Japan in World War II. It was maintained by Emperor Hirohito and also by General Douglas MacArthur. So those are the funds: Black Eagle Trust, the M Fund, the Yatsuya Fund, the Keenan Fund, and the Showa Trust. And we're going to be taking a look also at games. Games are what basically people that have attempted to bring this kind of information out have been subjected to. We'll get to that at the end of the book, the end of the program. Now, talking about the loot from Operation Golden Lily and its conversion into the Black Eagle Trust, again, a repository of Japanese and German loot, primarily gold, that became a giant political slush fund, a major, though largely unrecognized, element in post-World War II affairs, and it's something which wields profound influence to this day. The authors write of the Black Eagle Trust and its formation under the Truman administration: "The treasure, gold, platinum, and barrels of loose gems, was combined with Axis loot recovered in Europe to create a worldwide covert political action fund to fight communism. This black gold gave the Truman administration access to virtually limitless, unvouchered funds for covert operations. It also provided an asset base that was used by Washington to reinforce the treasuries of its allies, to bribe political leaders, and to manipulate elections in foreign countries. In the late 1940s, this agenda was seen as entirely justified because the Soviet Union was aggressively supporting communist and socialist movements all over the world, putting the survival of a capitalist world in peril. Most readers will be as surprised as we were by this information. Some may be deeply troubled by Truman's strategic decision, which others may heartily endorse. It is not within the scope of this book to examine that decision or to explore whether it was right or wrong. It might have been a wise decision at the time, which had tragic consequences in the longer term. Ours is only a preliminary report, and in what follows we try to remain politically neutral. The only purpose of this book is to lift the veil of secrecy and to bring forward and examine the unforeseen consequences, which are many and troubling. It was not Truman's decision alone. The idea for a global political action fund based on war loot actually originated during the Roosevelt administration with Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson. By the way, he was a bonesman from Yale. See, that's skull and bones. During the war, Stimson had a brain trust thinking hard about Axis plunder and how it should be handled when peace came. As the tide turned against the Axis, it was only a matter of time before treasure began to be recovered. Much of this war prize was in the form of gold looted by the Nazis from conquered countries and civilian victims. To eliminate any trace of original ownership, the Nazis had melted it down and recast it as ingots hallmarked with the swastika and black eagle of the Reichsbank. There were other reasons why the gold was difficult to trace. Many of the original owners had died and pre-war governments had ceased to exist. Eastern Europe was falling under the control of the Soviet Union, so returning gold looted there was out of the question. Stimson's special assistants on this topic were his deputies John J. McCloy, Robert Lovett, and consultant Robert B. Anderson, all clever men with outstanding careers in public service and banking. McCloy later became head of the World Bank, Lovett Secretary of Defense, Anderson Secretary of the Treasury. By the way, McCloy also became chairman of the Chase National Bank. He also was U.S. High Commissioner in Germany and a key member of the Warren Commission that covered up President Kennedy's assassination. Continuing. Speaking of Lovett, McCloy, and Robert B. Anderson, their solution was to set up what is informally called the Black Eagle Trust. The idea was first discussed with America's allies in secret during July 1944, when 44 nations met at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, to plan the post-World War world economy. This was confirmed in documents we obtained by a number of high-level sources, including a CIA officer based in Manila and former CIA Deputy Director Ray Klein, who knew of Santo Romana's recoveries in 1945. As recently as the 1990s, Klein continued to be involved in attempts to control Japanese war gold still in the vaults of Citibank. After briefing President Truman and others in Washington, including McCloy, Lovett, and Stimson, Captain Lansdale, eventually General Gordon Lansdale, one of the main post-war covert operations mavens, and also the person who oversaw the recovery of the Santa Romana Golden Lily loot in the Philippines. That's talked about in, for the record, 427 and 428. Beginning again. After briefing President Truman and others in Washington, including McCloy, Lovett, and Stimson, Captain Lansdale returned to Tokyo in November of 1945 with Robert B. Anderson. General MacArthur then accompanied Anderson and Lansdale on a covert flight to Manila, where they set out for a tour of the vault Santee already had opened. In them, we were told, Anderson and MacArthur strolled down row after row of gold bars stacked 2 meters tall. From what they saw, it was evident that over a period of years, Japan had looted many billions of dollars in treasure from all over Asia. What was seen by Anderson and MacArthur was only the gold that had not reached Japan. Far from being bankrupted by the war, Japan had been greatly enriched. We're going to look at the outgrowths of this loot and in the rest of the broadcast. Skipping down. Because the Black Eagle Trust and the political action funds it spawned remained off the books, some of these slush funds fell into the wrong hands, where they remain to this day bigger than ever. According to reliable sources in Washington and Tokyo, in 1960, Vice President Nixon gave one of the biggest of these funds, the M Fund, to the leaders of Japan's Liberal Democratic Party in return for their promise of kickbacks to Nixon's campaign for the American presidency. This in itself is deeply disturbing. But the M Fund, then worth $35 billion and now said to be worth upwards of $500 billion, has been controlled ever since by LDP kingmakers who use it to buy elections, to keep Japan a one-party dictatorship, and to block any meaningful reforms. Similar abuses with other secret funds are to be found all over the world. Secrecy is power. Power corrupts. Secret power corrupts secretly. As Japan expert Chalmers Johnson nicely put it, quote, the Cold War is over. Whatever the United States may have believed was necessary to prosecute the Cold War itself can no longer be used to justify ignorance about its costs and unintended consequences. The issue today is not whether Japan might veer towards socialism or neutralism, but why the government that evolved from its long period of dependence on the United States is so corrupt, inept, and weak. Now we're going to take a look at the actual concrete formation of the Black Eagle Trust. One of the points that I want to make here is to note how Japanese big capital and the political and economic forces that were to precipitate the formation of the Black Eagle Trust are inextricably linked with the Harriman, Bush, Rockefeller, Wall Street axis that we looked at in, among other programs, 445. Just as this powerful Wall Street axis had profound connections to Nazi Germany and to the underground Reich residua that grew out of that in the post-war period and that were allied with the U.S. during the Cold War, only ultimately, in my considered opinion, to come back to haunt us in the post-Cold War period, so too these very same elements, the Harriman-Rockefeller axis, is also inextricably linked with the forces that brought about Japanese fascism, and in turn with the forces that helped to perpetuate it in an underground but very significant fashion, first as a partner to the United States during the Cold War. But I believe, too, that the Japanese fascists and the elements that grew out of this nexus are ultimately going to come to haunt the United States and to subvert what is left of its democracy. The formation of the Black Eagle Trust, and again, key names Robert B. Anderson, John J. McCloy, and Robert Levitt, in turn tied in with this powerful Wall Street axis, of which, as we saw in our last broadcast, 445, the Bush family are a paramount element. Returning once again to Gold Warriors, what we do know from two separate high-level sources in the CIA is that Robert B. Anderson flew back to Tokyo with Lansdale for discussions with MacArthur. After some days of meetings, MacArthur and Anderson flew secretly to Manila, where they were taken by Lansdale and Santa Romana to some of the sites in the mountains, and to six other sites around Apari into the northern tip of Luzon. In the intervening weeks, Santi's men, aided by hand-picked teams from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, had successfully opened several of these vaults, where MacArthur and Anderson were able to stroll down row after row of gold bars. Other sites were opened in subsequent months. In all, the recoveries took 2 years to complete, from late 1945 to early 1947. From what was seen in these vaults, and also discovered by the U.S. Army investigators in Japan, it became evident that over a period of decades, Japan had looted billions of dollars worth of gold, platinum, diamonds, and other treasure from all over East and Southeast Asia. Much of this had reached Japan by sea, or overland from China through Korea, but a lot had been hidden in the Philippines. Washington's official public figure for recovered Nazi gold still is only about 550 metric tons. But Anderson knew better. One of his business associates saw photos in Anderson's hands of an American soldier, quote, sitting on top of stacks of bullion that Hitler had stolen from Poland, Austria, Belgium, and France. It ended up with the Allied High Command, and no one was allowed to talk about it, unquote. The same source said he was taken to the courtyard of a convent in Europe, where 11,200 metric tons of Nazi-looted bullion had been collected. After the Nazi defeat, the OSS and other Allied intelligence organizations searched Germany and Austria for art treasures and looted gold. Soviet troops and special units did the same in the Russian zone. More is known of what happened to the recovered art than to the recovered gold. When 100 tons of Nazi gold were recovered from a salt mine near Merkers, Germany, the truck convoy carrying it to Frankfurt vanished. It was said to have been hijacked, but the more likely explanation is that this gold was among the bullion stacked in the convent courtyard. The reason for all this discretion was a top-secret project sometimes called Black Eagle, a strategy first suggested to President Roosevelt by Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson and his wartime advisors John J. McCloy, later head of the World Bank, Robert Levitt, later Secretary of Defense, and Robert B. Anderson, later Secretary of the Treasury. Stimson proposed using all recovered Axis war loot, Nazi, fascist, and Japanese, to finance a global political action fund. Because it would be difficult, if not impossible, to determine who were the rightful owners of all the looted gold, better to keep its recovery quiet and set up a trust to help friendly governments stay in power after the war. This was informally called the Black Eagle Trust after the German Black Eagle, referring to Nazi bullion marked with an eagle and swastika, recovered from underground vaults of the Reichsbank. According to some sources, the Black Eagle Trust could only have been set up with the cooperation of the most powerful banking families in America and Europe, including the Rockefellers, Harrimans, Rothschilds, Oppenheimers, Warburgs, and others. I would add that almost certainly with their interests through the Union Banking Corporation to the Thiessens, the Bushes would have been involved in the German end of this as well. Continuing, a brilliant Wall Street attorney, Stimson was a man of immense experience who had served in various posts for five presidents, Taft, Coolidge, Hoover, Roosevelt, and Truman, but he was nearing the end of his extraordinary career. He knew Manila intimately, having served as Governor General of the Philippines in the 1920s. President Herbert Hoover had then named him Secretary of State. Like Hoover, Stimson thought highly of MacArthur. By Pearl Harbor, Stimson was already in his 70s. He managed his vast wartime responsibilities by delegating authority to four assistant secretaries of war: Robert Patterson, a lawyer and former federal judge; Harvey Bundy, Boston lawyer and Yale graduate; and two dynamos Stimson called his heavenly twins, John McCloy and Robert Levet. What they all had in common was their close relationship to the Harrimans and Rockefellers. Levet's father had been the right-hand man of railway magnate E.H. Harriman, who once tried to buy the South Manchurian Railway from the Japanese. Following in his father's footsteps, Robert Levet worked with Averill Harriman at the Wall Street firm of Brown Brothers Harriman, handling international currency and lending operations. And, of course, the Bushes, by the way, interrupting, intersect precisely at this point. Continuing, John J. McCloy, by contrast, was a poor boy from Philadelphia who graduated from Harvard Law School, joined the Kravath Law Firm on Wall Street, and gained the admiration of Averill Harriman by helping to get $77 million worth of bond issues for the Union Pacific Railroad. McCloy engineered such deals for everyone from the House of Morgan on down. Working for Secretary of War Stimson, Levet and McCloy became midwives at the birth of America's post-war national security establishment, which was closely interwoven with the financial community. McCloy was a troubleshooter and expert fixer. He said his job was, quote, to be at all points of the organizational chart where the lines did not quite intersect, unquote. He made endless trips around the world during the war, solving problems, working with statesmen, bankers, and generals. He was intensely involved in backstage strategy and understood, to borrow from Cicero, that, quote, the sinew of war is unlimited money, unquote. Money also was to be the sinew of the Cold War. A Wheeler dealer, McCloy knew all the ins and outs of international finance. After the war, he became a partner in the law firm of Milbank Tweed, which handled the affairs of the Rockefeller family and its Chase Bank. He became a leader of the Council on Foreign Relations, head of the World Bank, chairman of Chase, and head of the Ford Foundation. He may have been the key player in executing the Black Eagle Trust, the one who took Stimson's idea and turned it into a working reality. By comparison, Robert B. Anderson got off to an inauspicious start. Born in Burleson, Texas, on June 4, 1910, he taught high school for a while before studying law at the University of Texas. He was elected to the state legislature and appointed Assistant Attorney General for Texas in 1933 and State Tax Commissioner the following year. Then something clicked and Anderson left government to become an extraordinarily successful financial consultant of very rich people. By the early 1940s, he was general manager of the enormously wealthy W.T. Wagner estate, which owned ranch land and oil land all over Texas. Anderson was so deft at money management that President Roosevelt appointed him a special aide to Secretary of War Stimson with the responsibility for keeping tabs on the Axis looting. Navy Captain Clark Clifford, Truman's aide for national security matters, who was briefed by Captain Lansdale, was Anderson's protege and intimate friend. Together, Anderson and Clifford became major power brokers in post-war Washington. Although Stimson retired from public life in 1945 and McCloy also left government service at that time, they and Anderson continued to be involved in overseeing the Black Eagle Trust. According to former CIA Deputy Director Ray Klein, the gold bullion recovered by Santa Romana was put, quote, in 176 bank accounts in 42 countries. Anderson apparently traveled all over the world setting up these black gold accounts, providing money for political action funds throughout the non-communist world. Later, we closely examined several. In 1953, to reward him, President Eisenhower nominated Anderson to a cabinet post as Secretary of the Navy. The following year, he rose to Deputy Secretary of Defense, and during the second Eisenhower administration, he became Secretary of the Treasury, serving from 1957 to 1961. After that, Anderson resumed private life but remained intimately involved with the CIA's worldwide network of banks set up after the war by Paul Helliwell. Eventually, this led to Anderson becoming involved in BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, an Arab-Pakistani bank with CIA ties that parlayed money laundering and the discreet movement of black gold into the ownership of the biggest bank in Washington, D.C. The collapse of BCCI and what the Wall Street Journal called, quote, the world's largest bank fraud, unquote, also snared Anderson protege Clark Clifford, who was indicted for fraud. Clifford and his associate Robert Altman headed First American Bank Shares, the BCCI front in the nation's capital, and were accused of using political patronage to shield BCCI from full investigation. By the way, the BCCI investigation was obviously one that is inextricably linked with the milieu of both Georges Bush, and many of the younger George Bush's business connections grew directly out of that. The U.S. attorney, by the way, in charge with, quote, investigating the BCCI case was Robert Mueller, currently head of the FBI. Continuing, of the effect of the Black Eagle Trust on the post-war worldwide monetary system, battered and bankrupt by their long war in Europe and Asia, America's allies had no choice but to stand aside as the U.S. government set about the dollarization of the global economy. Economists see the end of World War II as year zero for the current system of international finance. Because of widespread suspicion that the Bank of International Settlements, BIS in Zurich, had been laundering Axis loot, Bretton Woods set up a new central financial clearinghouse called the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to act as the world's future financial clearinghouse and money changer. Gold was assigned a value of $35 an ounce, and all other currencies were valued against the dollar. This removed any doubt about the relative position of the dollar and the British pound, for example. Although Britain was a partner in the plan, she was deeply in debt to the United States. In 1941, in exchange for a $30 billion war loan, Britain had been obliged to take a back seat in post-war planning. Each IMF member country agreed on a value for its currency expressed in terms of the U.S. dollar. Each member country deposited with the IMF an amount of gold and currency as reserves to be used to sustain the value of that currency. The main function of the IMF was to maintain stable values for these currencies by shifting funds temporarily from one to another. While it was a global organization, its most important backer was the U.S. government. Federal statistics show that at the end of the war, the United States held 60% of the world's official gold reserves, which put Washington in the position of being able to manipulate the other nations. By 1960, however, it was evident to European members of the IMF that they would soon hold dollars far in excess of the official U.S. gold reserves. One solution would have been to devalue the dollar, but Washington blocked this. Instead, in 1961, the U.S. joined with the central banks of Europe, Great Britain, and Switzerland to form the London Gold Pool, managed by the Bank of England. The idea was that the collective official reserves of these countries would give them enough gold to intervene in the private market for gold to keep the price at $35 an ounce. It worked for a while, but by 1968 France had left the gold pool, the British pound had been devalued, and private demand for gold skyrocketed. In a last-ditch attempt to sustain the London gold pool, the U.S. Air Force made emergency airlifts of gold from Fort Knox to London. So much gold bullion was moved onto the weighing room floor at the Bank of England that the floor itself collapsed. It was an omen, for the gold pool itself collapsed shortly thereafter. And we will continue with this narrative on the second side of our broadcast. WFMU, archiving the For the Record programs, more recent programs streaming on Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL, linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. There will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 446 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. This program is Side 1 of For the Record program 446, titled Funds and Games, being recorded on February 15th of the year 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.